Okay, so what I'll be talking about today are two-dimensional bosons in an optical lattice. And this talk is going to be structured into two parts. The first part I'm going to sort of summarize some results we've had over the past 2 or 3 years to give those of you who don't follow exactly what we do sort of a speed up onto what I'd like to finish with. And I'll be completing on some newer physics we're working on that I have some data that came out of the lab in the past 24 hours, some really new stuff. All right, so some of the earlier data, what I'll be showing first, I actually took myself. And then we have rubidium-1 team on that apparatus. Some of the intermediate age data was taken. And then the newest stuff is in the rubidium-2 lab. That's my new lab at NIST Gaithersburg, Maryland. And then everything we do is sort of in a group structure. So I'm in collaboration with Trey Porter and Bill Phillips. And there's this logo over here that says Joint Quantum Institute. So we have a joint institute between NIST and the University of Maryland. And we would like to suck everyone's good students and let them be postdocs with us, okay? So that's the purpose of the JQI, is to take all the talent to College Park, Maryland. All right, so as Kuhn said, my background is a two-dimensional electron system, so I'd like to start there. So this is a little calculation I did in graduate school showing the lowest three subbands in a quantum well structure. And the reason I'm showing this is to sort of illustrate and remind you of the energy scales of this problem. So when I go to the cold atoms, you'll see the energy scales are vastly different. So this is a typical Coulomb energy for a density of about a typical density of 1 per 10 to the 11. Okay, so we're seeing about a terahertz. And this spacing here is sort of millielectron volts, and that corresponds again to terahertz type of energy scales. So we're talking very large energy scales. Now, to some extent, these two-dimensional electron systems are tunable. And what I mean by tunable in this case is when you ask Lauren Pfeiffer to grow you one, once you have that one thing he grew, what can you change about it? Well, typically, you can change the density, and you can see there's some subtle things in terms of strain you can do. You can put it in a magnetic field, and you can tilt it. And all these things have subtle effects, and the density is actually a pretty big effect. So what I'm plotting here is the growth structure for a double quantum well system. This is what I was doing these interlayer coherence experiments on. And there, tuning the density allowed us to cross probably what's a quantum phase transition. Okay. So density can be a very powerful thing, but that's not everything. So cold atom systems are very different, and you have a different set of good things and a different set of bad things about them. So an important thing to keep in mind is the energy scale is totally different. So we had about a terahertz, and now the typical energy scales for both interaction and single particle physics are in the kilohertz energy scales. And that means these need to be extremely cold as compared to the electron systems. So everyone knows we can make Bose condensation at these very low temperatures. So the coldness isn't the problem. But this coldness also implies a time scale. So almost all the dynamics we have can be coherent dynamics. So we can coherently control the atom on sort of the millisecond or microsecond time scale. And that's something that's very different from what's available in electron physics. So there's very few dissipation mechanisms, and this allows different opportunities to at least come to one of at the end. So what I'll be talking about in the entirety of the talk are atoms put into an optical lattice, and this will always be what I call a red-detuned optical lattice. And that means the atoms are going to be attracted to the points of local maximum intensity of the optical fields. So I have a total cartoon here of two counterpropagating laser beams, and here the atoms are going to be at the tops of these waves. Now if you were to go blue-detuned, the atoms would be at the bottom. They scatter fewer photons. But on the other hand, you don't actually get the coupling with the light if you want to use it for something. Okay, so here's my last super introductory slide. If you have a three-dimensional Bose-Einstein condensate, you've made it, you've evaporated it, and here's a schematic of it in one dimension. The red curve is the harmonic trap the atoms are trapped in. There's always this annoying harmonic trap there. So the density profile in the solid blue line is entirely inhomogeneous. There's no approximately flat portion anywhere in the system. So it's parabolic in this case, and we call that a Thomas Fermi profile. And this goes to illustrate the typical dimensions of our system. You can see the diameter there is about 20 microns. The blue dashed line is the ground state harmonic oscillator wave function and that potential that I calculated. And I just put that there because I think it's totally amazing that we cool these things cold enough that if it weren't for the interactions puffing it out to this Thomas Fermi profile, all the atoms would be in that harmonic oscillator state. And the trapping frequency in this direction is something like 24 hertz. I think that's just this amazing. So some other energy scales that are pretty small. The interaction energy is 10 to the minus 51 joules per cubic meter. And we have a pretty high density of atoms, so about 10 to the 15 per cubic centimeter. So that number isn't really small. That's the kilohertz number. But it's still pretty feeble. All right. So that's the first part of the introduction. So in these experiments, the title said two-dimensional Bose systems. So what we do is take our three-dimensional system and partition it into an ensemble of 2D systems. Okay. So what you're seeing here is the optical lattice, which is in fact superimposed upon the harmonic potential I plotted in the previous one. So the first thing you notice is that the actual scale of the optical lattice is much, much larger than the extremely weak harmonic trap that's on there. Okay. So that's just a sense of scale. A lot of times people show you pictures with a gentle sinusoidal modulation on top of a harmonic trap. That's totally unrealistic for what we do. So this is chop the three-dimensional BEC into these 2D subsystems. So it's like we're looking on it edge on here. And each of these sort of blue horizontal lines indicates the approximate number of atoms in these pancakes we have. So you can see here there's about 80 of these guys. And this is sort of the harmonic oscillator length now in each of these single sites of the lattice potential. So the way in the laboratory we do this is we have two laser beams which are almost counterpropagating. So we've opened them up, there's a little opening angle. And the reason we do this is we shine a laser beam through that opening angle that we take the pictures of the atoms with. And I'll show that schematically later on. So it's as if we retroreflected it. This 18 degrees makes the lattice periodicity a little bit bigger, but other than that, it's of no real consequence. All right.
So already you are decoupling the layers.
Yeah, so in fact, what I'll focus on for the first, say, two-thirds of the talk is I'll talk as if there's just one 2D layer. So there's 80 other layers up and down, but I'll talk about just one, and my language will imply to you that there's just one 2D system. And so here we're going to focus on gently corrugating these 2D systems, adding another two-dimensional optical lattice in addition to the 1D lattice that partitioned us into 2D systems.
And you can focus on the one layer because...
Because
the densities are different and...
Right, so for the last third of my talk, what I'll be talking about is focusing only on one layer in physical reality. So what we've published up to this point are ensemble measurements over this whole stack of 2D systems. So you're obviously losing individual system information when you do that ensemble type measurement. So we've been able to make some significant progress doing that, but we're working now on newer techniques to focus on a single or a couple 2D systems. Okay, so a quick introduction to the Bose-Hubbard model in this case. I'm sure you've all seen this. So you have a hopping matrix element. And physically, the magnitude of that measured in hertz is always less than 3 kilohertz. 3 kilohertz would be a very, very large tunneling matrix element. And typically, we have tunneling matrix elements of 10 or 20 hertz. So that's a small number as compared to the on-site interaction, which is typically about 2 kilohertz. That depends fairly weakly on lattice depth, whereas the tunneling depends very strongly, nearly exponentially, on lattice depth. So then you're tempted to write down a really simple Hubbard model like that with the tunneling and interaction term. And what I've neglected already is I haven't written down the external harmonic confinement, which you need to put in there. And I haven't written down a chemical potential. So there's an inhomogeneous density even in this case. And we atomic physicists like to say that our systems are perfectly clean. But for this discussion, I'd like to remind you that nothing in the world is perfectly clean. We don't have disorder as in crystalline impurities, but what you do have are weak fringes in your laser beam. So anytime you have a coherent laser field, any scattering source off the center will lead to fringes. Fringes are a cross term, so even like a tenth of a percent that's a part in a thousand of light can lead to about 30% fringe contrast. Okay, so you get a small light gives big fringes. So you have to be careful about that. So even if you're very careful, invariably you will have imperfections in your system. Okay, great. So here's what we do. This is one of the disadvantages, I think, of our system, is you get it once, you measure it once, you do a destructive quantum measurement, you make another one. So at time equals zero, we've made a Bose condensate. Okay, so now time is in milliseconds. We slowly turn on this lattice that partitions the system into 2D subsystems. See, that's over 200 milliseconds. And about halfway through that turn-on time, we turn on this two-dimensional lattice, which is corrugating the potential in each of these 2D systems. We hold for 30 milliseconds, we turn all the confining things off, the harmonic trap, the lattices, we let them expand for a bit, and we take a photograph of the atoms. So we might see some data that looks something like this. And to a large extent, data like that represents the momentum distribution of the atoms, although there are some imperfections there as well. This hold of 30 milliseconds is there because these turn-on times were not perfectly adiabatic, and also inevitably put some excitations into the system. So we give some time for those excitations to damp out as well.
The level separation within each well.
Okay, so the single particle separation within each well is typically about 30 kilohertz. Okay. So every piece of data I'll show today, as I was sort of indicating earlier, has an imaging direction which is looking up on the 2D lattice. So we typically would image momentum. So if we have an initial in situ image with our camera looking like that in a single 2D layer, after time of flight, we see an approximation of the momentum distribution, something like I've schematically illustrated there. So we measure x and y momentum as plotted on this figure. Now, I'm already trying to indicate with this totally classical physics cartoon one of the limitations, one of the reasons we don't measure perfectly the momentum distribution, and that is this little yellow region which represents the initial system isn't infinitely small. So there's no way we could possibly measure a momentum which corresponds to a separation between these time of flight dots, which means anything that's smaller than that. Okay, so this isn't the Fourier transform limit or anything like that. This just means we didn't wait long enough. Okay. All right, so that's an imperfection. So in the talk I gave last week, I invited people to interpret the images we see after time of flight as representing the momentum decomposition of the atoms. Now, a different but totally equivalent way to look at that is to think of these guys as sources interfering. So if you have some background in optics, you can think of this as a multiple slit diffraction being illuminated by a partially or totally coherent optical source. And once the light travels through these things, you get a diffraction pattern which looks like this. Okay, same thing as the momentum decomposition, but we're just rethinking it a little bit. And if you think about it this way, what the width of these peaks is telling you is something about the coherence length in this system. Okay? The overall shape here is telling you about the shape of these initial wave functions there. So that was just a little simple simulation. Here are some of our better looking data. So this is something that's pretty close to being free of imperfections, but not all of them. So we see this overall shape, which is a localized state wave function. And we see these three components, which are representing the breakdown into the crystal momentum components. So this would be sort of for atoms having almost no span in the crystal momentum variable. I'm going to come back to superfluid or coherent state data towards the end of the talk. But if we make the same little movie, now assuming there is no phase coherence between these little sources, you see a complete jumble. This is sort of like the non-insulating phase, but now there's maybe 20 sources in my calculation. So if you have perfect resolution, you'd see a coherent pattern like this, which represents the fact that each of these things are interfering with one another. It's just the phases are essentially random, if you want to think about it like that. So when you do that experiment with atoms, you see a picture which looks like this. So this is taken in the regime that we would call the mod insulator, hope we're cold enough to be in the mod insulating regime. And in that case, it's more of a quantum state, right, where you have one or two, but exact number of atoms per lattice site. So the previous calculation I did was a single particle calculation with random phases on every site. Here, it's because there's one atom per lattice site, you have an indeterminate number, indeterminate phase on every lattice site. And we'll go study this data in some detail now. Okay. So another way of reinterpreting that now in terms of interference is to say the lowest band here is uniformly occupied with equal probability, as it would be if either the phases were random or they're indeterminate.
So these are all simulations?
That's a calculation. No, most of what I showed is data. The thing after the movie is a simulation, but other than that, it's been data. Okay, so what we would like to begin is to understand what data out of the insulating phase looks like. So in the situation of the Bose-Hubbard model, naively, you have a mod insulator and a superfluid. So we're in a regime of a sufficiently deep lattice site coupling that we expect these indeed to be in the mod insulating regime. So what you measure are momentum distributions which look like this. This is a very deep lattice, a fairly deep lattice, and a moderately deep lattice. So all of them are in the insulating phase, where you see structure beginning to appear. And the appearance of this structure is telling us that there are correlations in the system. There isn't coherence, but there are correlations. So one can take as an ansatz that the mod insulating wave function looks like this. At lowest order in perturbation theory, you have terms that correspond to near neighboring site particle hole excitations, if you like. And you can calculate the momentum distribution from that perturbation theory wave function. And it predicts that the shape you should see is this Gaussian function times 1 plus a cosinusoidal modulation, which is that. So what we measure is the magnitude of that cosinusoidal modulation as a function of the lattice depth. And the simple first-order perturbation theory calculation is a red dashed line, and our experimental data points are there. So it's slightly shifted up in a probably statistically significant way, but nonetheless, we see very good agreement with the expectations of our calculation. So this is all these 2D situations. A similar experiment has also been done in 3 dimensions. This is Emmanuel Bloch's group.
So there's also, if you like, in zero temperatures, at least, there's also superconducting strip around. So what fraction does it have? So that would not be captured by your calculation.
Right. So in these lattice steps, you would calculate that the width of that strip is smaller than the lattice site. So there's not meaningfully superfluid anyway. And as we'll see later on, when we begin to attack the problem of temperature, probably it's a thermal gas anyway. Okay. So when I switched to this field of cold atom physics, I discovered a term that I thought I knew about. That term was quasi-momentum. Now, I thought quasi-momentum had something to do with the crystal momentum of excitons or something like that. But it seems that the atomic physics community thought that to redefine that as meaning exactly the same thing as crystal momentum.
It's a Russian technique. The Russian has been calling it.
Yeah, so I may slip and use the word quasi-momentum because now I've heard it so many times. But if I say that, think crystal momentum. All right, so what we can do is take these images of atoms which represent the momentum.
Is it restricted to 2D? Like quasi?
In the Russian literature, the crystal momentum is called quasi-momentum.
In any dimension?
It's just the terminology. And then somehow in Europe, then they started for atomics, they adopted terminology. Sorry.
Yeah. So I don't know the history of it, but nonetheless, I will use them interchangeably. So we can take a momentum distribution of atoms like that. These little sort of black squares are meant to represent the image of momentum. That if you were plotting it in crystal momentum, would represent different Brillouin zones. And the system, of course, has this lattice translational invariance. So if it were quasi-momentum or crystal momentum, you'd expect these things to be the same. So the way to interpret what these things are a product of the quasi-momentum or crystal momentum distribution like that, sort of shaped by this Gaussian profile representing the on-site wave function. So you have some recently deep lattices, you can break it down like this to a Vanya function term and the actual quasi-momentum distribution. And using data like this, there's an optimal way to back out what the quasi-momentum distribution is in a sort of an optimal data processing way. And you get pictures like that of the quasi-momentum and the lowest Brillouin zone. So the model assumption, by the way, behind that kind of thing is that there's nothing in any higher bands. So if you do...
Have you checked this?
Yeah, we've checked it. So there is nothing in the higher bands. We've taken some data in a different situation where we intentionally populate higher bands, and we can certainly see that. All right, so what we measure now are these quasi-momentum distributions. The reason we went to the trouble of doing that is because everything that is published theoretically is in terms of the quasi-momentum, or at least was when we were doing this experiment. So if you take a cross-section through this quasi-momentum distribution and compare it to theory, you get this curve. So the red line is theory. It's not the first-order perturbation theory. I looked a little bit harder, and this is the random phase approximation theory. And you see it agrees pretty well with the data. Now, as always, when I made these figures, I plotted the data with which it agreed, and did not plot the data with which it didn't agree. And in particular, the random phase approximation is still a mean field theory, and that means it predicts the location of a critical point at the wrong spot. So if I am to continue going upwards, the random phase approximation predicts a phase transition before it actually happens. So that means the momentums near zero acquire a divergence. So that means this works up to about this point, you get less agreement there. So in any case, another way to plot this data, which I think is a little bit more quantitative, is to take out the second order term, the second order Fourier term from this random phase approximation, and compare the second order Fourier term in our data to that. That's a black curve. So that also agrees pretty well with what we measure. So what we conclude from this is that we're cold enough that we're comparing to zero temperature in a non-insulating phase isn't an entirely wrong thing to do, and that the calculational tool and the experimental measurements are at a level that at least the insulating phase, they agree with each other pretty well. So another experiment we did, which we're not going to learn a lot of physics from this, but it's really neat, and maybe you guys can think of a way we can learn physics from it, is we measured noise correlations. So maybe 4 years ago, Eugene Demmler was going around saying you can learn everything from noise correlations. This is... You measure a spot of atoms here and see how correlated it is to a spot of atoms there. And that was just the neatest thing in the world to me. So I went and did the experiment. And this is sort of saying, if you look at a fluctuation there and look at a fluctuation there, how correlated are those two measurements? Okay. So I'd like to go back to my little toy calculation again, which I think will illustrate the point a little bit better. So here, this is the random sources up top. They're completely random, but if you look, you'll see that there's a maximum there, 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 and there. And those all, maximum are all separated by twice the photon recoil of the lattice recoil. And in fact, there are minima spaced by similar amounts. So there are correlations in this noise, even though there isn't the first order coherence. To me, this is bringing out one of the really great things about the atomic physics system. Now, it's disappointing that every time you make a BEC, you destroy it when you measure it, because then you have to go make another one, right? That's different from your electron systems, where you measure it for many months until your cryostat plugs up. Okay, but when you're making these projective measurements, that means a lot of the things you learned your first year in quantum mechanics are kind of coming true. So you measure an image like that. What I've suggested we've measured is the expectation value of the intensity, right? The probability of finding a particle at x and y. And that's not really true, because I only made one measurement. The only reason that this is approximately that is that my pixels are kind of big, so there may be 25 atoms in every pixel, so it did some kind of self-averaging. But if that weren't the case, you'd see a bunch of little spots measuring the location of atoms. You're measuring a position, basically a position measurement. So to take a measurement like this and go to that, you have to average over many images. And that's actually the power of the whole correlation function thing, is that what you do is you take an image like that and you do some kind of image processing to it, whatever you want, and then you average the processed image. And if your processing had any nonlinearities in it, it's just like you did that same nonlinear function to the operators and then took the expectation value. So that's really fascinating. So what we, in fact, measure is a signal which looks something like this. It's a correlation function normalized to what the correlations would be if you first averaged, then did the correlation function, so a correlation-free object. If you assume you're in the mod-insulating phase, then you predict the structure will look something like this. So these are basically diffraction peaks, but now this isn't in the first-order coherence, but it's second-order coherence. Okay. So here's the paper in which the Harvard people predicted this. And as I said, they were going around telling everyone about it. So Emmanuel also did the experiment in a 3D system, and we did it in a 2D system. And the long and short before I show the data is you actually learn almost nothing about the systems by doing this. All you do learn is that they're on latticites and they don't have coherence. Okay. So here's an image now, a picture of the momentum distribution averaged over many realizations. And you can see that a lot of the noise went away. So any correlations have disappeared from this. So these are now the average versions of the data I was showing earlier. Here's a region where we hope that there was some superfluid and some insulator. Now, if you look at these correlations, you see these peaks appear. So this says there's a probability of finding an atom there contingent upon first having found one there. Okay, that's pretty neat. And the structure doesn't really change even if you get very, very close to the superfluid insulator transition. You still see it. This looks noisier simply because there are fewer atoms in the diffuse bit of the image. And after we did this, we began to ask ourselves, what can we learn about the system by doing this kind of experiment? And one thing you can learn is about the spatial extent of the system. So in any kind of diffraction experiment, the width of the diffraction peak is proportional to the linear extent of the number of sources giving rise to it. So what we measured in this case is the integrated weight under these peaks and plot it as a function of this parameter T over U. The red dashed line is some really simple model of how big the shell structure ought to be if an insulating phase is there. So right, this is what you were getting at. If there's some ring of superfluid, it's going to get bigger as you get close to the critical point. And here we're saying that probably the insulating phase is getting smaller. So as far as I can tell, this is the only thing you can learn from these correlation measurements. But it is an observable we have that maybe if you can think of something else, that would be fantastic.
So you're saying the area under which is the total size of the...
Yeah, so if you make the... So what we did actually is we took an image and then we excluded those pieces of the image where there were sharp diffraction peaks. Okay. So if there's some bit of superfluid, we see that's almost all giving weight in those diffraction peaks. And we process the remainder of the image. So then any noise we see has to result from some fraction of the system that's in the insulating phase. And the width or area under the peaks pretty much equivalently is telling you about the number of sources giving rise to that. Now,
What was now the main problem that you didn't see anything useful? So that you couldn't think of because the state just didn't have any useful correlations. Second reason could be because you have these many layers and you average over them and that they essentially destroy your signal. Also they give
a
noise which you don't want, you're not interested in, or what is the...
Well, if you assume that you have one or many layers, it doesn't actually matter as long as they're identical. If you actually do
they're not identical. If they're identical, it would be still a self-averaging thing.
Yeah.
It reduces your noise by a factor of like number of layers.
Right, and we take that. We take that into account. But what I'm saying that's even in principle annoying is if you do the first order perturbation theory calculation that I did, which modifies the momentum distribution, it doesn't modify the noise correlations.
So the main reason is there was nothing to measure.
We didn't know that going in. Yeah.
So if you would have, let's say, had a proper anti-fog net, for example, then you would, with your resolution measurement, you would see this when you do this spin down type of.
Yeah, sure, that would be a problem. Yeah, and I think that while that kind of antiferromagnet hasn't been measured, people have certainly now put super lattices on and done noise measurements there, and seeing that you can see the density structure resulting from those super lattices being on. So, which is, you know, the same signal to noise you would need to measure an antiferromagnet.
So just to clarify, so you were saying, what's wrong with the Daimler's argument that you can see a lot from correlation?
What you see with the correlation functions ultimately are geometric properties. So, for example, if you have spin up, spin down, spin up, spin down, giving an antiferromagnet, you'll see that because it's associated with the geometric property. But what you don't seem to see anything to do with are coherence or correlation properties. I mean, probably at higher order you do, but.
But it's a limitation of the experiment. I mean, in principle, you should be able to see it.
Well, yeah, certainly you can see that those dots we see are relatively low in the signal to noise. So if you need a 1% effect, we're probably not going to see it. Yeah.
How accurately do you measure the noise? Can you, for example, suppose I only correlated the points at near the surfaces? Can you
near the surfaces?
Well, suppose the question is, suppose I try to measure the noise correlation around or the points around the person with surfaces. You can discuss how to measure. The question is
the surface of what?
Of the sometimes surfaces, maybe the a certain momentum range. Now, the question is whether one can use that to reduce temperature.
Right, so after we did the experiment, I did another calculation, which was what would the noise correlations be for a series of marbles that you randomly tossed into a bunch of buckets? It's the same thing. So, yeah. So the other thing that both our group and Emmanuel's groups, so I'm concerned that you probably wouldn't see anything to do with temperature. At least in the insulating phase. You have this picture, and we a priori don't know what to take out of it. I mean, you can take the coherent-looking parts out, but other than that, I don't know what to do. But anyway, the other thing, we don't fully understand. I've said, you know, we fully understand, but we don't fully understand. So if we fully understood, these points would be at 4, and the noise signal is half of what we expect. And we see that, and Emmanuel sees that, and the Italians who have done this now see this. So the noise signal we measure is about half of what we expect, and we really don't know why. Now, in producing this noise signal, you can see there's this N, so we put the expected number of sources in, but we have pretty good knowledge of the number of atoms. So somehow, when we do measure noise, even in the region where we believe we should understand it, the actual signal is less than we expect.
Oh, so you can have some to zero, and you don't get half of it.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole analysis assumes that once you took the atoms out of the lattice, they ballistically and completely freely expanded, and we all know that's not true. There are collisions that go on during the expansion. So things like that will reduce the noise weight, but I could never make that effect be a factor of 2. Okay. So now what I'd like to talk about is the coherent phase, the superfluid phase. So I've taken an extreme example here, but we see a picture which looks like that. We take a cross-section through it, say along that line, and we measure these red peaks. So we say, we've measured the momentum distribution in the superfluid phase. Now, we know our Vanya functions pretty well, and you saw how beautifully the dashed line went through the insulating phase data. But here now, we should see these peaks lying upon this black curve, and they don't. So I had this data when I was here at KITP 2 years ago, and Jason was saying we should all sharpen our experimental swords for effects like this. And what's going on here is not actually a finite size effect. It's an interaction during time of flight effect. So this peak actually has the right number of atoms underneath it, but it's not near as pointy as it should be. What's going on is during the time of flight, the atoms are repelling each other and expanding more rapidly at regions of local high density. So what this means is when you have regions of local high density, physical high density during time of flight, it makes the images much more difficult to interpret. Now, we can avoid that by throwing away some signal. So what we do in producing pictures which look like this, which look very, very nice, this is much, much narrower than what you saw on the previous page, is we take our cross sections out here. So that's, we're looking in regions of local low density. And the price you pay by doing a thing like that is you've thrown out almost all of your atoms. So you have to have worked very hard with your imaging to be able to do that. That's what we've done. So if you did a similar cross section elsewhere, the noise here would be appreciably smaller, but this would also be appreciably broader. So what we're trying to do in this experiment is resolve the location of the transition from superfluid to insulator as accurately as possible. So the first set of data I'm showing is a very naive measurement. This is a measurement I might make if I don't know anything whatsoever about the theory. What's that? Oh, yeah.
Wow, so now you have, you can actually analyze the interaction effects also. If I go back to the heated state.
Right? Yeah.
I see. So
but we can, when we get to the end, you'll see we can really analyze the interaction effects properly now with a different approach. So what I'm plotting here is the ultimate naive experimentalist measurement, which is how wide that peak is. So I'm presupposing absolutely nothing about what's going on, nothing about the existence of a transition, and there's no fitting or anything. It's just the full width and a half max of the peak. And what we observe is that it's narrow and then gets broad. So we have a really simple fitting function, which is a power law over here and a constant there. And using that function, we identify the point where it begins to get broad. And we associate that point as a transition from superfluid to insulator.
Why do you use log scale on your team?
Because in the lab, that's approximately how the lattice depth is going. So our linear control parameter is the optical intensity in lattice beams, and that's more or less exponential in that frame. And besides, it makes the transition look really sharp.
That's what I thought I'm trying to do, but you have better reasons.
Yeah. Okay, right. Well, this was just to remind us that most of what this width we see here now is still not the Fourier limit. It's still the initial size of the system. So we start with the system that's about that big on my camera. I take a picture of the system, it's that big. After time of light, I have a circle that big, it's about as big as those peaks. Okay, so we're finite size limited. All right, so I'd like to now go back and talk about more in the parameter regime we chose to perform our experiments. So the first experiments that were done in the Mod Insulator with Emmanuel and Marcus, a sort of famous paper, had a relatively high number of atoms per lattice site. So what they did is have an in-situ density distribution which looked kind of like this, where you had an insulator of ones, an insulator of twos, and insulators of threes, and that's fantastic. You still see the loss of coherence and everything. But we'd like to, as accurately as possible, measure a phase transition. So here is sort of the line of different effective local chemical potentials in the local density effect sense that gave rise to that well-calculated profile. So what we've done, and now what people are more and more doing, is worked at very low densities. So this is simplifying the measurement, but at the same time, we're losing any measurements we might make out there. So by working at lower density now, the in situ density profile looks like that. So the only things that exist in our system, and in fact have been true for everything I've showed you, is a unit-occupied mod insulator region and a superfluid shell, or an entire superfluid at higher coupling. Okay, so here's sort of a mean field theory calculation of what might this correspond to. So there's the density profile and only a little bit of superfluid. And this is in microns, so 1 micron is 2 lattice sites. So that might only be 4 lattice sites wide. Okay, so I told you we measured the peak width as a function of the lattice depth, or U over T, and saw a sharp transition. We can now presuppose a little bit of knowledge about the system. We can presuppose we know that they're cold atoms, and we know that at least in the shallow lattice, they should pretty much look like free bosons and fit to a suitable fitting function. So we have data like this. There's a sharp peak in the center, so we can try to fit that peak to something. Oops, I was hoping to have that. We can say that those atoms are somehow not condensed. We can say that those atoms somehow are condensed and make it a suitable experimental fitting function. So we tried to put all the physics we knew about to this fitting function. So this fitting function, it knows about finite time of flight. So it knows how the Vanier functions expand and suitably convolves with the initial system size and all these kinds of things. We took this part here in all of our fits to be a Boltzmann thermal distribution in the sinusoidal band. So we did not use the Bose-Einstein distribution. And we took this peak to be an inverted parabola in situ that expanded during time of flight. So that's our model fitting function. and we will only and exclusively apply that fitting function. When we do that, you get a couple parameters out. Now I get to go back up. I'll use this one. We can now measure what we call a condensate fraction, and that's simply the fraction of the atoms which are under the pointy part of our fitting function. And you can see that quantity, too, also drops to near zero at the same place that the width began to suddenly increase. Now, those are strongly correlated measurements because when we're measuring width, if there's a broad part and a fat part, when the peak gets short, ultimately the width begins to represent the measure the width of the fat part instead of the short part. So this isn't really measuring something independent. Okay. Now, as we began to do this measurement, we began to think more carefully about something which I haven't talked about, which is temperature. And we're most certainly not at zero temperature. So the evidence already in front of our eyes that we're not at zero temperature, aside from the fact we live in the physical real world, is that there's, even at the very shallowest lattices, there's that bump underneath there, which should properly be interpreted as thermal atoms. Now, when the lattice becomes deeper and the condensate peak decreases in size, more weight appears there. That probably has an effect due to the adiabatic change in temperature, but also is, quantum depletion coming in. So that's not a good measure of temperature here, but it probably is here. So when you see a condensate fraction of only 40%, you might begin to wonder what's going on. Is that a thermal effect or not? Now we're in two dimensions, so there's no reason to believe there should be any condensate fraction except that we're in a trapped system anyway. So we can't presuppose we'd expect to see my fit function produce 100% condensate fraction even at zero temperature. But probably something's going on. Now, somewhat more recently, we began to do pretty more and more careful comparisons with theory. So homogeneous system quantum Monte Carlo produced a transition point slightly larger but close to what we see. Now, in this case, this is some more recent inhomogeneous system calculations using now a parameter which is called the characteristic density, which is supposed to capture the fact that the system is somehow inhomogeneous. And the bottom axis is as it always is. So when these guys take our data and compare it now to their finite system size quantum Monte Carlo, we see that our two locations, transition point location measurements, either by this full width half max measurement or this condensate fraction measurement, are within the uncertainties of our uncertainties are within their zero temperature calculations, but we're still both systematically shifted to smaller values of U over T. And that's exactly what you'd expect to see for a finite temperature system, that the transition into the superfluid phase, whatever that means, occurs at a smaller and smaller value of U over T, until finally at some critical temperature it doesn't occur at all. Now, what temperature are we at? I have up here something that says 40 nanokelvin initial temperature. I think it's actually closer to 35. But if we do a fit to this, as I said, using a thermal distribution in the sinusoidal band, we can extract out what the temperature is. And as the lattice becomes shallow, this saturates at some number, which in tunneling units is 2, and which corresponds, in fact, to this 35 nanokelvin.
What is this entropy, a particle?
I don't know. I mean, I could do a classical calculation and give you the answer, but in the 2D system, I've got no idea.
So this is determined from what now, this 40 nanokelvin? That's...
If I make the... What went into determining that number is assuming that the population of atoms giving rise to that bump in the background there are somehow thermal. So they should be described at least in their wings by a regular Boltzmann distribution.
You should try to do it before you switch on all the lattices?
Yeah, it was exactly the same number. Hmm? Well, just a second. If you do this before I put on the 2D lattice, so if I have pancakes, I get exactly the same answer. So these peaks just disappear, except not put on a 2D lattice. And I'm going to actually answer your question properly in a couple slides.
Okay.
So we began to realize that the theorists who've been talking to us like Jason have been right, and that finite temperature could be very, very important. So we began to produce pictures which look like this, which aren't these idealized zero temperature diagrams anymore. This is a finite temperature mean field theory. It's sort of intending to illustrate that as a function of this U over T parameter, the critical point shifts to ever and ever smaller lattice depth, smaller U over T, at higher and higher temperatures. And what I'm plotting here is a cross-section right through there of that diagram. So there's some critical point above which you never have a superfluid insulator transition at all. You're always normal. And some published data is in that regime. You can look at their data or look at their parameters and realize they never had a superfluid at all. Most of the published data is at low enough temperatures that you're in the superfluid and you go to something like an insulator transition. Okay, so we began to take data like this. So here is something showing images like I showed before. This is now much, much newer data. Everything else was about a year and a half old. And now we're revisiting this problem. So this is about 3 months old. So this is a new apparatus, produces higher quality data and all that. In any case, we go from superfluid to insulator. And what you see is more or less what I showed before. The height of the peak is decreasing. And at least in the shallowest lattices, it looks clearly bimodal. That the black one, this intermediate red one, you couldn't associate any particular a narrow structure and broad structure to that. That looks like one distribution. It's taken right about there.
But you're not moving along this arrow. You're moving isometropic. So
not the same. Yes, exactly.
So this is kind of, kind of meaningless in the sense.
Well, I measure my temperature in units of T. So at least initially here, I'm actually probably doing a pretty good job. When you get close to there, yeah, sure, you can go rocketing up like that. And I don't know the right temperature.
I'm not sure, even in the superfluid phase, that's a low entropy phase. And so the entropy will change strongly
yes.
as a function of temperature, even within the superfluid
of
phase.
Of course.
So and your experiment is same fixed entropy, not fixed temperature.
Right.
So you're not crossing on a horizontal line in any sense.
Yep. So now when we go vertically.
But these people, this is all that's field theory.
This is
finite temperature mean field theory.
Yeah.
So does the same phase diagram also exist where you put entropy on the axis instead of temperature?
Oh, sure. I mean, I calculated that I can do anything I want. But, okay, so anyway, what we can also do is fix the lattice depth, or fix the coupling U over T, and go up or down in temperature. And if we do the data, you see something qualitatively similar, although this feature always looks somewhat more bimodal.
Okay. How do you do this?
So what we actually do is we produce a system which always has exactly the same number of atoms, and then we add some heat to it. Okay, so we're a fixed number, then we're changing the temperature. And now we're going to get to the problem. In fact, so we have a set of data. Okay, all right, I wanted to make this point too. So now previously I showed data where we had a peak condensate fraction of about 40%. We're able to now go colder, and we see a peak condensate fraction of nearly 80%. If you extrapolate these curves down, they're pretty noisy, not ready to publish. You see that overall, even between the, say, 50% and 75% data, there's a slight shift to deeper lattice depth of the transition point. So as you expect, when you go colder, we do see that the transition from the coherent data occurs at a slightly deeper value of lattice depth. That's what we expect. So if we take all the data we've taken so far, you see something which looks like this. So I've labeled the vertical, it should be quotes. This is warmer, and that's colder. And this is going to be a problem I'll get to in a second. So we add some entropy or some heat to the system. So these are curves of effective constant entropy. We go to some particular lattice depth, and we ask the simple question, is there a pointy peak or not, as described by the fitting function I described to you earlier. If there is a significant pointy part, more than about 5% of the atoms, I give it a large pink dot. The X's are extrapolating curves like I showed you on the previous slide, measuring where the condensate fraction goes to zero. And the black dashed line is absolutely nothing. It's just the curve. So there's some region where there's a superfluid-like part or a condensate-like part, and there's some region where there's not. So that's great, but there's a problem. And I would like that vertical axis to have real dimensions. I'm somewhat unsatisfied with entropy added in quotes. So this is getting to what we're working on right now in the lab, and this is getting back to a question you were asking earlier.
So why are you not satisfied with the entropy?
I didn't measure. I didn't.
You didn't. You want to measure it directly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And I want to measure it directly at different values of the lattice depth.
So how do you define the vertical axis?
That's exactly the point. It's tied to a lab control voltage, and what we need to do is independently measure that. For every data point, I need to measure that, and that the problem is I can measure it for the shallow lattice points because I've convinced myself that looking at the tails of the distribution produce the temperature. But as soon as you make the lattice ever so slightly deeper, there's some fraction of quantum depletion, and then there's no way of knowing what the temperature is. So there's no way of measuring the temperature. And I'm not satisfied with assuming isoentropic curves and just saying what the temperature should be. We would like to measure the temperature. So that's one of the things we're really working on. Now, so here's this 33 nanokelvin associated with that point. Now, the really funny thing is that we started out with a BEC at 5 nanokelvin. This is when, so all we did at this point here, basically, is turn on a 1D lattice, and we see it got a lot hotter. The first thing you could say is that, well, you were sloppy, and we were somewhat sloppy in this experiment. But if you turn the lattice on and take it back off, you're not at 33 nanokelvin. The 3D BEC got a little bit warmer, but not much warmer. We've gotten better at this, and we still see a systematic effect. Now, I've tried taking the data for which it's most extreme. If you start with a 3D BEC and turn on a one-dimensional optical lattice, this is an entirely thermal distribution that has a condensate portion of about 50%. There you see no condensate fraction in a much hotter system. If you turn that same lattice back off as isoentropically as possible, you end up with a 3D BEC at about 30 nanokelvin with a large condensate fraction. So by going from a 3D system to a 2D system, you're suffering the inevitable fact that whatever transition happens in a 2D system is at a lower value of entropy per particle. So this has really motivated us to take a step back from that.
So basically, you're showing that the process is hard to keep it to be adiabatic, basically.
No, it's adiabatic.
But I thought you turn it back and your system at high temperature.
A little bit to higher. It went from 25 to 30 nanokelvin. It was imperceptibly different. The pictures, you couldn't tell the difference in analysis.
But how do you know the temperatures? I'm not sure I got to get the picture straight.
So if I take my 3D BEC and I turn on a 1D lattice and then turn it off, if I showed you the pictures, you couldn't tell the difference. Now, if I do a careful analysis, I see the temperatures increase a little bit. We aren't perfectly adiabatic, and you should never believe that we were. But it didn't increase a lot. And what I'm telling you is that you can go from a 3D system where there is a clear condensate fraction to a 2D system where whatever we were associating with a condensate fraction isn't even there. And you measure vastly different temperatures by fitting to the Gaussian part of the distribution. Okay. So, and this was already apparent in our very old data. In this apparatus, we couldn't make systems really cold, but we saw that we started with a nearly pure BEC. Then in 2D, the condensate fraction was only 50%. And at the time, I actually thought we were being sloppy. But it turns out there's some physics behind that. So we're seeing some effect of going into reduced dimension. So what's going on here? So we have some questions then. So this is what's going on right now in the lab. So the first thing we want to ask in an experimental sense is we've taken this 3D system, we've partitioned into 2D systems. Are the 2D systems in full equilibrium with one another? We would like them to be. The next thing is, how does the temperature change from 3D to 2D at fixed entropy? I've showed that it clearly does, but those were ensemble measurements. And the last thing is, can we directly measure the temperature even when we put on the additional 2D lattice? And the answer to the question 3 is going to be yes, provided one and 2 are satisfied. We learn about 1 and 2 is okay. So let me tell you about then what we're doing in this regard. So we would like to measure a phase diagram like this and replace that axis with something like temperature in nanokelvin at all the points, where that is a measured quantity, or temperature in units of T or entropy or whatever. But right now, it's an inferred quantity, and I'm unsatisfied with that. Okay, so I made a little movie. This is just purely gratuitous. But what happens is we start with a 3D BEC, and then we turn on an optical lattice, and it's deformed and ultimately partitioned into a stack of 2D systems. And what you can see is this is really very different. So the stack of pancakes is topologically unconnected to the 3D system. So it's easy to believe something violent can happen. So what we would like to be able to do is to talk to just one or a couple of these things. And this kind of thing in an NMR approach has been done in cold atom systems before. This was used for the first and only existing measurement of the shell structure in ultra-cold atoms by Emanuel's group. And the basic idea is to put your atoms in an inhomogeneous, in our case, a linearly varying magnetic field. So we have an optical trap we put a magnetic field gradient on, and we have an RF transition, or RF field, that can couple only a selected subset of the atoms between the different states. Okay, so the most naive way to do that is to apply a brief pulse of radio frequency radiation and to flip the spins of only some subset of all the atoms. Okay, and that's what's been done before. And you can change the frequency of your pulsing field and measure, for example, as was done in this paper, the density profile in a vertical direction. That's great. We can go a little bit further and do something that I think can add extra information, and that is we can ramp the radio frequency from there to there. And what you do in a ramp, it's called adiabatic rapid passage. We have three internal states, mf equals minus 1, 0, and plus 1. We start in mf equals minus 1. This adiabatic passage flips the spins as you pass through. When you stop here and abruptly turn off, the atoms which were in resonance are 50% projected into mf equals 0 state. So spatially, you see a decomposition of mf equals minus 1s, a little bit of 0s, and plus 1s. And by determining the intensity of this field, you can control the width that you're addressing there. Obviously, a larger width increases the number of pancakes you address. At the same time, it gives you more experimental, signal to measure. So there's some compromise you can do there. In principle, on paper, this technique can easily measure a single pancake, although I'm somewhat skeptical that we'll get any good signal to noise there. And so this is data that's been coming in over the past, this is 24-hour-old data now. So what we've measured...
Did you go back to take the data and come back here?
No, I have a grad student working on this, and I've been emailing her, where's the new data? Where's the new data? It's my motivational strategy while I'm in Santa Barbara. So what we're doing right now is we have a 3D BEC, so the simplest system you can imagine, and we're applying a very brief pulse of radio frequency. So this is not the adiabatic passage technique, this is the pulsing technique. And almost all the atoms are in the initial BEC, so there's some different field gradient on during time of flight right now to resolve the images, which has nothing to do with the pulsing process. These are the atoms we intentionally flipped, and there's a three-level problem, so some population ends up in the three state. If you just measure the number of atoms there, you get what looks like a Thomas Fermi profile. I've added a fit to it so you can be convinced it's an inverse parabola, which you shouldn't be convinced of. And you measure Thomas Fermi radii, which is completely reasonable, of about 6 microns. So this is an approach which is really working for us. And now, how do we address the previous issues? So what this allows us to do is some things independently. We can measure the momentum distribution of small groupings of atoms. We can take a particular slice, expand it during time of flight, and perform the kind of temperature measurements I did before. That is to say, fit the wings, get a temperature out. But the other thing we can do is we can measure the temperature as a function of position by counting the number of atoms. So we're in a harmonic trap. So that's another harmonic degree of freedom. So if I, with a better signal, produce a curve like this, there'll be a small tail there. It'll increase, and there'll be another small tail. So now we can measure the positional distribution of atoms. That tells us temperature in a very different way. And these numbers better be the same. So this is the data that hopefully is coming in today and tomorrow, again, with a 3D BEC. So this can really help answer the second question, is how does the temperature change from 3D to 2D at fixed entropy? So we should have, in the end, a system that's isothermal. We hopefully will have verified that by number one. We're going to see different condensate fractions, even without the 2D lattice, in each of these 2D systems. Now, once we've done that, we can finally address three. So this technique of measuring the spatial density profile will still give us temperature once we're convinced that it's working, even in the presence of an additional lattice, since the atoms will still distribute themselves in the wings like a thermal gas. Okay, so that's where we're going right now. And the other thing I didn't mention why the adiabatic passage is nice. The reason this is nice is we measure those atoms, and those atoms. And the ratio of that to that measures your position in your system of atoms. So you don't have to rely on any kind of calibrations. You get a direct measurement of the fractional distance of the detected atoms as a function of these two guys. Okay, so that's where we're going. And there was one more thing. So this apparatus also is equipped with large coils that can hit Eschbach resonance and rubidium 87. So in addition to changing the depth of the lattice to change the parameter U over T, we can also directly change the scattering length of rubidium 87. So rubidium doesn't have any nice Eschbach resonances. So this is field measured in Gauss. So at 0.1 tesla, at a kilogauss, there's the only even reasonable Eschbach resonance around. Its width from there to there is about 200 milligauss, and you want field control much better than that. So it's a bit of a technical problem. We want about a part in a million level field control, and we've achieved that. So here we've finally measured the scattering length as a function of the field difference. We're able to go down to about 30 milligauss from the resonance. But the Achilles heel always of these Eschbach resonances is you increase the various losses in the problem. So here we're in the absolute sort of spin ground state, so the only significant loss are three body loss processes. But what you can see is that going from essentially a typical rubidium BEC to the point at which we can measure losses reliably, these losses have increased in about three orders of magnitude. And to go to increase the scattering length only by a factor of 10, we have many more orders of magnitude than loss to deal with. So the Eschbach resonances aren't the answer to everything. But what they can reveal, answering your earlier question, Jason, is the role of interactions during expansion. So one of the things that I think this is...
But why do you bring in Eschbach resonance? What good one to see interaction effects in expansion? Is it why
Why am I telling you about it, or why did we build it?
Why did you do this experiment to go to fresh virus?
Well, we have some molecular. So I'm gratuitously showing everything we're doing in this lab.
And but what's the motivation of doing fresh virus on this lab?
So the initial motivation was, in fact, to do our quantum information experiments, which I haven't touched on at all, and in which case you only have two atoms involved and three-body loss is not an issue. Since then, we found other ways to do those experiments. Now, what we're initially planning on doing with this is looking at 1D physics, where strong anticorrelations already exist, so the three-body loss turns into a measurement instead of a vice, and it's suppressed anyway. What I was answering Jason's question about is the other thing that's very useful is we can always work close to this resonance, and after during time of flight, hop to a point where the scattering length is zero. Okay, so turn off the interactions during time of flight and get rid of that sort of polluting element entirely. That's not our primary motivation. We never build this to do that, but it's something we can do.
That when you tune it close to resonance, apart from three body loss, you also have a loss because the things pop in higher bands and then things would also move out. Right?
For this particular experiment, that's right. So if we had this on when the lattice was on, of course, there's other neat things
that
happen.
Oh, this is on the lattice.
These measurements, just to show that we can make the measurements, are in a BEC.
Oh,
but in the context of the talk today, what we would actually do is sit at high field, not at the resonance, mm-hmm. turn the lattice and the trap and all that off, and then hop to near the resonance where the scattering length is zero, and turn off this annoying fact that there's mean field during expansion. Mm-hmm. All right, well, anyway, this is the last slide. I've tried to give you a sense of what we have done and where we're going right now with this project. So, thanks.
Questions for Ian? Comments?
So how does the condensate fraction change with the number of particles in the waves?
So, no, we've always deliberately worked at fairly low density. So we haven't done experiments where we controllably change the number of atoms. And the reason for that is actually pretty simple, is if you want to be at fixed temperature or something, it's actually, these apparatuses don't rely, there's no number changing knob, which is sort of, I mean, what we can do is make a program that produces a BEC with 100,000 atoms of some condensate fraction, and then we can change the temperature or something, whatever. And then we can rewrite the program a little bit to produce 200,000 atoms with the same parameters, but there's no nice knob you just turn. So what we've decided to focus on was this regime where there's typically one atom per lattice site and fix that constant.
I have a couple of comments, and I think not that much about the specific comments on certain items. I think also as a matter of communicating to the investment community. I think the first comment, the first comment is on momentum, on the fitting of momentum distribution. I understand that is a very convenient fit and also it keeps a good agreement with the Monte Carlo calculation in certain region, maybe perhaps except near the quantum critical region. I think I think in the last year or so, there are more and more understanding of the momentum distribution. The meaning of the peak and onto the wing, and also I think there are also strong evidence both from Monte Carlo and from theoretical calculation that if I really have a good superfluid, then they are actually trimodal structure rather than bimodal structure. But of course, then one can only reduce some of those features with the appropriate higher positions. I think the reason I mentioned it is not that much for this particular experiment, because I think if those features are, well, from condensate method viewpoint, those features are really controlled by some very general principles, and in the future when we go to others more intricate superfluids like fermion, etc., and some of those features would also appear. Now, and in addition, I think there are also high temperature series expansion from I think some of those information are coming out. I think what the theories are lacking at the moment is a convenient way to tell the instrumentalists. I think it's our job maybe that's another equally convenient way they can fit it, and then they can do equally good, and one can also extract some information. I'm not criticizing. I do have comment that there might be in the future, but it's a better way to fit it. I think, but what I'm trying to say, there are really physics under that peak which can be explored. The other question is, I think, the other comment is, that I think in your data, that you, if you have high resolution density, that's why we have, I think that your last data is very exciting. If you have enough accuracy, that we believe that there are ways that you can just from your density profile itself, you can map out the, it's not only one data point you can map out, in fact, just from that density profile, you can map out the phase diagram, but you can discuss it. Mm-hmm. Later, I think so we're just praying that because you and you're one of the few people, you're good, one of the few groups that has such high quality data. So I think it's really important to push the accuracy higher. And I mentioned a couple several weeks ago in one of the talks that I think we are now in entering the regime, the era of doing high precision quantum many-body theory that
can
lead to a lot of new results, but we do need high precision.
No. The only thing I have to say, I'm very conservative when I do fits. So as long as you give me no more than 3 free parameters, I'm willing to do a fit.
I think yes, a theorist's job to give the experimental community a better fit. I think the only problem I have with this fit is that, I mean, it looks like a thermal thing and something, it just looks like it. However, if one examines clearly, then this thing is actually contains both quantum division and normal division. And inside this peak is not everything condensing. In fact, one can show that there is a singularity. If you have super fluid by just for general principle, there must be a single contribution from the normal part. So the question of how much under this chunk of stuff is normal, is super fluid, need to be examined carefully. And I agree that we need to give the community a better way, a remote, easier way of analyzing. Not every time you have to go to Monte Carlo or some complicated calculation that you want to have to understand.
So are there questions in addition to soliloquies?
So I guess to have a 3D system, having a 2D system and having these guys to have the same temperature is kind of conflicting with each other, so there are conflicting goals. Because when you say these two layers are not interacting with each other, then there's no reason why they should have the same temperature. I'm just asking about, so you suggested that you kind of believe that there's uniform temperature in these different 2D systems, but that's conflicting with a statement that they are separate systems.
Well, the question is how separate do you want them to be? And I think the intuition that we bring from electron physics is the right one. And that is you want the equilibration time to be a small time as compared to the particle exchange time. And if you're in that limit, I'm willing to say they're independent. So that would be my only comment.
In principle, there is a window, but you can't do it. Well, if you say you can wait, if you could wait very, very long, then there would be no problem. But you're kind of limited in your experimental time. You're not able to wait very long.
Yeah.
So when they are kind of separated, then it's very difficult to exchange entropy between the system. And because the only way how these particles can exchange entropy is really via hopping. So the only way to transport information is really hopping from one layer to the next layer. That's not very efficiently suppressed. So having the same temperature is kind of unlikely in this setup.
I think what would happen again that requires precision measurement. What would happen is that if I really gradually turn up eventually, but so at the beginning they communicate and then the different things they communicate with their temperature. But at some point, then as you say, then you begin to cut off. So what do you just keep turning up the latter side? You keep then at some point, beyond that, then they begin to separate in the sense that the equilibrium time. Now, but beyond that, if I continue to turn up the lattice, so now you have an isolated object now. Each one of them would equilibrate within itself. So therefore, I have a different pancakes, but now I'm squeezing them in a sense because I'm turning up the lattice. So beyond then, gradually they would have a slightly different temperatures. But beyond it has to be because the compression in each pancake is slightly different, and when you compress it, everyone would rise the temperature a little bit.
The compression's exactly the same, nearly exactly the same. The larger difference is the number of particles. So near the periphery, you're going to be in a region which is always somehow thermal. And as you get towards the center, whatever the condensate that we have is will appear. And there are significant entropy effects. So to answer your question, it's a matter of time scales. So the time scale of these experiments can be, say, 100 milliseconds long. So if I live in a regime where the tunneling time maybe is 10 milliseconds, probably I'm OK.
This tunneling time. The perpendicular tunneling time.
Yeah. But then the good question to ask is, what number is that? It's not the tunneling matrix element. Here you do Fermi's golden rule because you have this rapid interpancake equilibration. So you don't just get to read off in the band structure. You have to do a little bit more work.
If I may ask something else, so really I haven't understood, how do you want now to determine the temperature? And this completely
is. So if you believe for a second that I have worked in a regime where the 1D lattice, say, is sufficiently shallow that I am fully equilibrated between the different pancakes, then I have two different ways to measure the temperature. Whoops. So let's go back up. Okay, so I'm producing data which looks something like this. So I have some small group of atoms which I have selected out from the larger population. Now, by looking at those atoms, I can do what I always do and do it. This is now time of flight, so ostensibly momentum distribution. I can always fit to that and pull out the temperature from the wings of the distribution, so with some thermal appearing atoms. Okay, so
you make this fit that there's a central peak and then there's a...
Or initially do my experiments at high enough temperature that there's never anything. What I want to do as an experimentalist is to reassure myself at different levels of complexity that the temperature is good. So the first experiment you do is at high temperature where there's never any confusion from condensate fraction at all. So you believe you're kind of simple. So then you say, okay, everything is more or less a Boltzmann kind of particle, and then I'm going to fit this to a Gaussian and get a temperature out. So then as a function of my RF frequency...
This puts a lot of theory in it.
It's pretty theory-free as far as I'm concerned, because as long as I'm in a regime where it's Gaussian and it's Gaussian at higher temperatures, I'm comfortable that it's thermal. As long as it's always, if my Gaussian fit doesn't work well, I'm no longer comfortable. But there's going to be some self-consistency here.
So what about the alternative? What carries information on temperature, which is kind of theory-free, is when you go to the in position space to the part of the cloud where the system is extremely dilute.
Right.
So the observation is much below one, and you can neglect the action effects. And now, if you're addressing, it seems that you can measure something like the density. As a function of position, and that should have very nice theory-free.
So at the high temperature limit, we get temperature two ways. We get temperature as a function of position by measuring momentum distributions, and in aggregate by measuring number pictures like this. The wings, fitting to those wings, gives you a separate measure of temperature. And at high temperature, these numbers should be the same. Okay. So if I measure that at high temperature, I become happy with number one.
So you can do the addressing both directions, this way and this way.
So what
because
we...
kind of it's nice to do it this way because of this...
So what we do is we measure many images separately, each one measuring... So this is imaging now along the direction that's going to have the 1D lattice on. So this is the same imaging direction I've always used. Now I do many of these RF experiments and count the number of atoms aligned along that direction. Okay, so that is that direction.
You can do it both directions.
We could do that in another direction too.
We're hoping that the Yen student will produce a lot of data at the tail and then blow it up and then you can see something nice.
We should be able to do that. The system produces data pretty quick. And it's going to be averaging there, but I'm fine with that.
So can you do it in a deeper lattice? Like, I understand you, this one is in the shallow lattice or no lattice, but then can you...
Well, of course, we can do this in any lattice depth we want. In fact, the BEC is the hardest case because it responds... When you start turning the RF on, you change the potentials and it begins to respond. When you have the lattice on, those response times are smaller.
So
the only thing that... you ask a question which has two answers. The in-principle spatial resolution is as small as you want it to be. The in-practice spatial resolution is limited by the time by magnetic field noise in the laboratory. Right. So this frequency is determined by a resonance condition, which is first order sensitive to Zeeman field fluctuations, and I know what those are. So that gives me a sensitivity which depends upon some other parameters, but realistically it's going to be about a micron, which gives two lattice sites. Now we probably will work maybe where there's a couple more to increase our signal, but with 80 lattice sites, the four nearby sites are pretty much the same. So you were asking about measuring the wings of individual pancakes. Now remember, if I chop it the other direction, I'll be integrating over pancakes.
Right.
More questions? If not, let's thank Yan Bian.